today's podcast is not exactly what I wanted it to be. It's Thanksgiving. I'll talk about a little bit, you know, when we're recording this and why in the podcast itself. But I just want to apologize because due to a computer error, go figure, totally different issue this time around. It's not the new computer yet. Due to a computer error, we lost like 15 minutes of it. And the conversation ends up in some really good places afterwards. Sadly, we never quite get back to what we had at the start. And it wasn't theology. It was about being a writer, being in the creative process, if you're an artist, a producer, a hobbyist, any of those things. And it was really valuable. So sorry that didn't get to you. I guess all I'm doing now is announcing my grief and making you feel bad too, so you can share it with me. But nonetheless, I think you're going to enjoy this conversation between myself and Pastor Brian Wolfmuller. We are all over the place, from Ben Shapiro to Adolphus Gustavus, the Lion of the North, to there's some writing stuff and discipline issues, the discipline of writing, the work of writing, the theology of heroes, good stuff. So for this Thanksgiving Day, a little break from Revelation, and I do hope you enjoy this conversation with Pastor Brian Wolfmuller.
I'm looking for ways to kill time.
I'm sure you are, because you're the laziest guy alive. And now we are recording, and we have it for posterity to know that yes. Brian Wolfmuller's got nothing to do. Especially after we just wasted, now we've wasted half an hour. We had 15 minutes of good conversation there that is gone to the winds, probably because of my lack of power going to my laptop, through which I'm running too many things at once, and I didn't know there was no power going to it. But oh, for goodness sakes. Welcome to the show.
Why not waste time talking to you?
There is nothing that bothers me as a producer of things, a maker of things, more than having to do the same thing twice or even trying. I know we're not going to have the same conversation we just had, and that's what bothers me so much. It's like it's just lost. Anyhow, well... Listener, thank you for tuning in on Thanksgiving Day. This is the Thanksgiving Day edition of Raw, soon to be something else. Looking forward to rebranding in the future. But in the meantime...
Really? What are you going to change it to?
That's a secret for the moment. I'm just trying to build up tension. You know what I'm going to change it to. You're the one that helped me figure out that I was finally going
to
land on it.
It's going to go from raw to cooked.
That's right.
Fisk cooked.
That's right. Medium rare.
Well done.
I'm on vacation right now, it being Thanksgiving Day, so this is actually being recorded ahead of time, and Brian is sitting in with me to just help me have something to throw at you, keep you entertained. We're going to talk today a little bit about...
You not entertained?
A little bit about the task of writing, which is what that conversation was about before, and I don't remember, you were about to say something really, really pristine and genius right when I realized that everything was going wrong. But anyway, we're going to talk a little bit about the task of writing so far as we're still interested in it. And we're also going to talk about Brian's own book he's working on right now. Has American Christianity Failed? I should say, Brian's own book he's not working on, which he's already been paid for, which is due in like 3 days, right? It's a little more than 3 days.
I don't know exactly the details, but that sounds about right.
So we'll see if we can help you out just by spreading those juices. But again, I want to talk about the writing task because it's something that it does matter to me. It's what I studied in undergraduate. And I'm also going to be having another interview this week with another pretty well-known author in at least Missouri Synod circles about the writing task. And then we'll release that one next week. So kind of two in a row. What does it mean to be a creative? What does it mean to be a producer of things? And if you're not that interested, I'm sorry. I'll tune in 2 more weeks. We'll get Revelation rolling again. But where were we? We had so many good things. We talked about the difference between talking and writing. We talked about writing what you know, but being interested in what you don't know. We talked about the avoidance or the reason to write or the reason to produce largely being the avoidance of some sort of pressure or guilt or pain that you just have to get that off your chest, and the only way to do it is to write.
That's you, not me. That's that big thing. That's probably the biggest difference between you and me is that, you look at writing as it's almost like a bloodletting for you.
It is.
You know, these people who have their knees swell and they got to go and they just have to have the fluid tapped or else they just can't even walk. That's like you, your imagination, and writing. It's you got to go to the leecher.
Yeah, it is. I mean, and that's kind of where we left off. I just shared this, that it is if I go through a work day on which I do not write, so my weekend days, you know, Sunday, this doesn't quite count, but, you know, a Monday through Friday, Monday through Thursday, in which I do not give attention to the writing task that I believe is the most important thing for me to write right now, for a variety of reasons. We could look into why you write any particular book, but if I don't give attention to the one that I have on my conscience, it doesn't matter what else I achieved that day, it doesn't matter how good a person I was. I mean, I could have walked on water, and I would have been like, nope, I'm still a worthless bag of flesh, because, and it's not because, it took me a long time to realize this, Brian. I didn't realize this until I heard other writers talking about it, that half of the reason for my depression is that I didn't write that day. And once I figured that out, it's like, man, now I need to move into that realm. We talked about this a little bit too, the discipline of writing, right? This is not something you just sit down and you don't just write a book, right? You write words, and those words have to become a book. Man, you had good stuff about that way at the front. I don't know if you want to try to repersonate any of your ideas about structure.
It's just, some of it is the difference between writing a book and writing like an essay or a sermon or something shorter, is that you know, at least for, like, if I just, as an example, if I'm writing a note to somebody, just a one-page note, I'll stop and I'll look at it, and my handwriting is different at the beginning of the note than it is at the end of the page.
Isn't that funny?
It's annoying. It's terrible looking. And that's the problem, is that when you're writing a book, if you can let me extend the metaphor, that you want your handwriting to be the same in the first chapter as it is in the last chapter, and they're 89,998 words in between. So you're trying to keep the same rhythm, the same pacing, the same kind of speed of thought, speed of reading, the same shape to the words, the same vocabulary. You're trying to keep it the same so that people can recognize the same voice at the beginning of the book and the end of the book, which is very tough. So you have to start. So the book kind of is all arising at the same time, at least in the way that I have to work, is that you have a structure, you have an idea, and that idea breaks out into major sections, and those sections break out into chapters, and those, even the chapters have a certain form to them, an opening and an end, and so that you're kind of building it out at the same time, so that writing a book is like building a house, and it all has to sort of happen together, which is tricky because, as you pointed out, you can only write one word at a time. You can't write five words at a time. It's one after another, one foot in front of another. And yet you got to know the last step, or at least you got to know the pace that you're going so that your last step is the same distance as your first step.
There's something amazing about, and you were talking before, again, sorry, listeners, it's too bad. We're just going to reference stuff we were talking about before. You know, how you finally...
You should have been here.
You
would have been here. You had to be there. That's how the joke...
You were staring at a blank page, and you finally decided that you just needed to talk. And so you went down and stood by a podium and typed as you talked, as if you were teaching a classroom, which is a good way to get going. But there's this reality that occurs that... And I don't know how to put my finger on this. It's like we make more sense when we're talking than when we're writing, even if we use the same words. And the word on the page demands more clarity than words in a classroom do.
That's one of the reasons why a book is so helpful, because you don't have anything else. Even when we're sitting here talking, we have our voice and our inflection to make things make sense. We can pause. We can start and stop. We can reflect. We can laugh. We have all of this emotion available to us in a voice. And in a book, that is muted, and the words themselves become the chief thing. And so you want people to be able to hear the you're writing, but you don't have the advantage of the voice or the video or anything else like that to get you there.
So you've mentioned the word voice a couple times now, and earlier you were talking about it, and you were talking around this idea that in writing theory, they call finding your voice. And this is about getting to a point where you're comfortable enough leaving the same handwriting all over whatever you write, right, as it were. But there's a difference, too, between just finding your voice and then saying what you want to say with that voice. And that's the challenge of, you know, stripping away your own confusing images or words. I'm going to tell a little semi-story to kind of give you an example. So the thing I'm working on right now, that is just driving me crazy. But I'm finally in conversations with CPH about it a little bit again. And I thought I had, you know, kind of gotten really close to the end of the book. And Laura Lane at CPH just said, hey, can I see the first chapter? And I went, oh, sure. I'll just give it a quick run through. I'll just look at it. And I go back, I look at it. I hadn't looked at it since probably last February, last March. And I didn't get through the first paragraph for 2 days, like 2 hour-and-a-half long sessions. I'm in the first paragraph again because I'm like, I don't want to speak French here, but what are you even thinking? No one is going to know what you're saying. And oh man. So I spent the last 2 weeks hopefully making it make some sense. And I sent that thing off yesterday, but like, I'm not even sure now. It's like, maybe it didn't make any sense. I know what I want to say, but I have no idea if I said it.
I know. The writers will say it this, they say writing is rewriting. And, you know, you're working in drafts, so you're writing in waves, and that is so frustrating. Oh man, I think for you, and maybe even this might frustrate me more than you, I hate to look at something twice. Yeah. I hate to do something twice. Yeah. I hate to go over the same territory a second time, but it's the second time and the third time and the fourth time and the fifth time that actually is making the thing worthwhile for other people. And that is just, there's an agony in that. Oy. And it has to do with this thing that we were talking about before, which is that, so we have to write the stuff that we know because the books that we want to read are different than the books that we have to write. I was thinking about this a lot because I'm always tempted to write the book that I want to read. But the problem is if I want to read it, it's because it's bringing me something new and fresh. And if something new and fresh, people can tell. People can tell if you're just sort of, if you're making stuff up or if you're writing, especially theological writing, if you're writing from a place, if you're drawing water from a deep well, if people can tell that you've thought these things through and you've wrestled with them before and you've applied them and you've seen how they've worked, people can tell that versus if you're just making stuff up. So even though for the example, like I'm sick of talking about the conscience for one thing. I mean, I guess I'm not sick about it, but I'm much more excited to talk about some of the new stuff I got cooking. But I've spent a lot of time meditating on and thinking about and studying the conscience. So it's good for me to write that stuff. I got to write the stuff that I know because not everybody knows it. That's the point, is that the Lord divvies up these gifts in different measures.
Is curveball, is the conscience worked into, what's the title again? Martyr's Faith in a
Messed Up World. Messed up world? It is. Yeah, for sure. It's going to be in there, especially when we talk about the battlefield. Where is the spiritual fight happening? And there's three places that the Bible talks about where spiritual warfare breaks out. And heaven, the throne room in heaven, and in the divine service, and in the conscience. So we'll have to talk about that and how the three estates protect the conscience. That'll have to be in there. Although I think I'll just have to, I mean, I think I'm mostly just going to have to hand those pictures to people as a glass of water and then keep moving on because, you know, it could be a whole book on the conscience and it's not time for that yet. So.
Well, I guess that's what I'm asking. So why is it not time for that yet? If you're already tired of talking about it, then you got to do it before you never want to talk about it again.
I know. That's especially the three estates and the anti-catechism. I probably got to write a book about that, but it's still cooking. There's still a little bit more. There's still a few little pieces that need to come together before that's ready to be written down.
Yeah. I can just see Horace now saying, you know, imitating you, you know, the thing about the conscience is the three estates. And like he didn't get the three estates in.
It is something we talk about this, how guys have a shtick, and I hate that. When people ask me to come and talk, they say, well, would you talk about like, has American Christianity failed or the conscience or three estates? I'm like, no, just, I want to talk about something. Assign me something that I don't know anything about. And let me go dig into that and find the new thing and start to make the connections. But there is a difference. You know, when you think through a thing a few times and you're able to pull out some points and to speak it with clarity, that's when you become helpful to everybody else. And so there's a reason why people have shticks and that they end up becoming books and things like this. It is helpful, I suppose.
But I'm right there with you where I can't stand repeating it. And so at the very least, I want my shtick to only be done every so often, right? I want to have multiple shticks and like, what's it? Switch out my shticks from time to time. So like one of the things I've talked in the past multiple times on the apologetic for the resurrection of Jesus. I think it's huge. I think it's so important. I think it's really fascinating, but I can only do it like once every so often. Because it's just like, how many times can you say the same thing? But then that's the call you talk about a transition. That's the particular challenge of a preacher, isn't it? Like we are not.
I think so.
To be creative. That's not what we're here for. We're here to repeat the same thing. What was it? Recently, I think one of the readings in the 3 year, it wasn't Romans 8, but I'm going to say it was Romans 8 because it'll make sense. It was John 1. And like I didn't want to preach on it because like, well, everyone knows John 1. Everyone's heard this preached a million times. And I was like, wait a minute. I don't think I've ever actually preached on John 1. I just think I know it. And so maybe I should like talk about what's here. And this is the real trap we have as preachers, right? Is that we start to think people know what they need to know or what the texts are. We complain, oh, every pastor preaches Romans 8 all the time. Yeah, but when was the last time you actually preached Romans 8? You avoid it, you know? I don't know.
Yeah, that's right. And there's a different level of attention that people are giving to different things. So we're giving attention to whatever it is that we're working on, the scripture text that's before us for the sermon and all this sort of thing. And attention is what's an energy? It's a muscle. It's a work to give something attention. And so you give yourself, you give your attention to something for a long time and it wears you out, but then no, other people aren't paying attention to it until you put it before them. And now their attention is to it. And so for the reader, it's very, very fresh. And the other difference, I mean, it's one thing. So to be a writer and a reader are different. They're related to each other, but they're very different because what, when you're writing, I mean, I think about this all the time there. You start, you say that you put down the first word of a sentence and then the next word you've got, I don't know, 1,000, 2,000 words that could go there. And you're trying to sort between one of the 2,000 words that are available to you. And then you got your third word and you could go there. You got 50 words that could go there. And then your fourth word, you've got 10,000 words that could go there. And maybe there's 20 that fit and you're trying to pick the best one. And every single word is there as this labor of choice. And you're trying to select which one and trying to fit it all together. It's why you know that there was an infinite amount of choices that you made when you were writing a book, and every single one of them could have been better. Every single word could have been a better word. I mean, this is why the really great writers, as you just say, that was the word that needed to be right there in that place, and there couldn't have been another word. That was just exactly the perfect one. But I'm certainly nowhere near that. So every single word that I write is a little moment of regret. And by the time you get to the end of 50,000 or 90,000 regrets, you're just ready to throw it out. But the reader has it totally differently because the reader is not making those choices when they get to each word. They're actually receiving each word. And so every word comes to them as a surprise. I didn't know that was coming. Here it is. That's something wonderful and delightful. So for the same amount of regret that the writer has in every choice that he makes, the reader has that degree of delight when they go through it. So that the attention that the reader gives to the topic that's being addressed is a life-giving sort of thing. And it's really quite wonderful.
That's pretty cool. I've never really thought about any of that the way you just described it. You were talking earlier, and this is kind of connected, about the kind of the terror of the blank page. And that's where the regret and the challenge of the next word comes. And I don't think anybody who produces anything creatively, whether it's an art piece or a music piece, unless you're Mozart, you know, a few really random geniuses who are plagued by the genius to just, they have to do it and it just flows out of their heads. Most people, they have an idea, they know what they want to do, but then they get to that moment of starting and it is overwhelming because of the amount of choices there, because of the fear that we create in being misunderstood or in miscommunicating and in doing a poor job. And so I'm not good at this. I'm saying it because I want to get good at it. The task of drafting needs to be thought of as not actually writing, right? That and this is where your talking point really helped. That your first draft really should be expected to be bad, and that's what stops you from writing, is you want it to be good on the first try. But instead, you should just barf the draft out there, and you go back and you're going to find three diamonds in that barf that are actual real points. And then you got to find the words that belong on either sides of those diamonds that connect them to each other, right? And then pull them apart and recraft. And then you got to do that again and again and again. And it's no longer just about connecting words to each other. The place that I find the most fascinating in the editing process is connecting the sentences to each other in the paragraph, and then connecting the paragraphs to each other. So, for example, I was talking about this chapter I was just looking at, and at least two or three different times in the process, I'd get to near the bottom of the chapter and I'd realize that an entire paragraph belonged way up further where I'd already talked about it. Or maybe it was just one sentence that was just kind of hanging down there, and it made sense where it was, but it really didn't the same way it would if it was connected to what was before. And that's the process then of that when you as a reader, you come in, and I think that's the process. As a reader comes in and think, oh, that was so well written, it just flowed. Well, it's because of this digging task of mining the ideas out of where you've had them kind of haphazardly land on the page and put them into the constructed order that they need to be. But what stops us from ever getting there is we won't just barf them out on the page in the first place. Because we want to believe so well of ourselves that we just kind of, you know, make Michelangelo's David every time we try.
Well, we talked about one of the things that the Lutheran fathers identified is that apart from the gospel, if you just have the law, your two options are pride and despair. And it's the same thing with everything, but especially with art and with writing, that there's the writing of despair, which is, this is just absolutely horrendous. And then there's worse, which is the writing of pride. Like, here I am, you know, I fart rainbows. It's just, you know, the most beautiful thing that's ever been written. But both are wrong. both of them are, you can't judge yourself. But that's another problem with writing, is it's such a solitary task. Unlike teaching in Bible class, we're standing there in front of people, and it's this interaction. It's something of a conversation, or even in an interview, or when you're creating other new media and you get this instant feedback. I mean, if you post up a YouTube video, you're going to see if it gets 100 likes or 1,000 likes or 10,000. You get this immediate feedback. But when you're building a book, it's like you're working in the dark. And so you have to wrestle with all those quiet voices that are there. This is the best. No, this is the worst. No, to somewhere in between. For me, the only way out, by the way, for me, and this again might be a difference between you and I, is that I don't think of myself as a writer, but rather I think as a teacher, or like a theological builder. I want to build theological stuff, and so if I have a certain thing that I want to teach, I'm then asking, well, what's the best way to teach it? And sometimes the unfortunate answer to that question is that it's a book. I wish it was never a book. I wish it was always something else. But sometimes just the best way to get the beautiful thing that I see, to get the beautiful thing that I see in the world, and most especially in the Bible, the best way to get that vision into someone else's imagination is to write a book about it. So then you have to go to the unfortunate task of writing a book. I mean, I wish there was another way to do it, but that oftentimes is simply the best way to get the thing from me to everybody else in the world.
I don't think there's any question that the most permanent way to ingrain a pattern of thinking, not just knowledge, but knowledge goes with this, into somebody, is for them to read it. TV does a lot for convincing you of things, of moving your emotions. It's a fantastic tool for that. But radio does a lot as well for forming sort of the agenda of your worldview, the boundaries of your worldview. But nothing will make you able to talk about something like reading something. It just has a particular gift for that as a tool. And then you can add to that its enduring quality. It is quite phenomenal how a book may endure. You know, we certainly have digital audio and visual media that is enduring-ish in the white noise of America. There are movies that stick around for decades. But I'm pretty convinced that 50 years from now, Worldview Everlasting videos, neither here nor there. I mean, maybe they'll still be out on the internet somewhere. Maybe someone will find them. But Echo or Broken has a significant chance of sticking around 150 years from now. And not just because Echo or Broken. I mean, maybe nothing makes it from my hand. But if something's going to make it, if something's going to impact people beyond my lifetime in a beneficial way for the gospel, for the church, it's not going to be a video I make.
Yeah.
It just
that's
isn't.
Right. No, Echo. That's right. Echo is a classic. I think Echo, I'm not sure about Broken, but I think Echo has will have long, long legs. But
I hope so.
And you're right about this. I have this, I think, really more clear now than I ever have. And that is that to be a theologian, you have to read theology. So that everything that we're doing in the realm of theology is towards books. And not just towards the books that we're working on, but towards the old books especially. That we're headed towards Luther, we're headed towards Chemnitz and Gerhardt, we're headed towards the Church Fathers. That's the end of the road that we're on. And so that every theological meme, every theological tweet, every theological Facebook conversation, every theological podcast, every theological YouTube video, radio show, and everything else like this is pushing. It's just one step closer to an actual book. And that to be a theologian is to be engaged in theological books. So there has to be books at the end of this that we have to be, and we have to continue to produce these books. And there's just no other way. I don't know why that is. Maybe in 10 years we'll know why. But I don't know why the goal of theology or the way to theology is through theological books. But I know it is. I mean, you could even go to seminary. So imagine this, Jonathan. Imagine you went to seminary, you were there for 4 years, you went to every class, you attended every lecture, you went to chapel every day, but you never read any of the reading assignments.
Sounds like 2/3 of my class, I think.
you would not be a theologian. You just can't, it's not enough. You could go to Bible class every week, but if you're not, and there's something about sitting there and engaging in the text, and especially in engaging in these old texts, because they demand things of us. They demand thought, they demand effort, they demand a respect for the person who's writing, and they demand a self-respect to be able to stand there and engage with them. It's there's something really important there. So sometimes, yeah, I mean, even though I'd much rather make, again, 10 YouTube videos and 20 podcasts a week than write a page, sometimes you have to write a page.
Yeah, man. You got about 3 different directions I want to go. I'm gonna come back to this idea. I don't think this quite connects to what you said, but you gave me this idea a moment ago that, why do certain books demand our attention over time? Why do we call them the greats? So you mentioned Luther, you mentioned Chemnitz. I'd throw Sasse in there, I think, eventually. Maybe not. Maybe he'll vanish. But it's almost like the... in the making of many books, which has no end, we need to keep that. I'm not saying this well at all. That proverb does not mean we should not make books. We need to keep making books. And maybe the reason for this is that the making of books is functioning very much in the same way that editing your first drafts are. So that as we're reading and writing and reading and writing, there is this more pristine text that eventually rises to the surface in a generation. Or in
That's
a year, right?
Right?
But that only happens with all the other texts being written too, and all the other conversation that all the books are creating. And so, you want to read the best stuff and the greatest stuff, but you also then want to be involved in the stuff that's producing it at the. And maybe not, but I don't know. This is kought of a not a very clear
no. That's right.
Yet.
I read something about how Isaac Watts wrote something like 2,500 hymns.
Wow.
Yeah, and there's going to be some good ones when you write that many.
that makes me think of Jim Gaffigan. He said, "Man, I got to get a job."
That's right. But there's a I was listening to the audiobook the other day on reading the classics or something like this, and it was making the same exact point, is that there's just as many books, well, maybe not as many, but just as many books published back in the days of whoever. I mean, pick one of these old famous authors. Jane Austen. During the days of Jane Austen, there's just as many books published as there are now, but we've forgotten all of them, but the best three, the best one.
And they're all by white men like Jane Austen. Oh, wait a minute.
Sorry. So you're all anti-social justice warrior lately on Instagram.
Yeah. Well, no, yeah, I got addicted to Twitter again for the last couple of weeks, trying to break that habit already. But I don't know. It's the madness, dude. The madness drives me crazy. I can't believe, and some of it is conversations I've had with friends and extended family and the inability to see the connection point between the absolute loss of truth in all things, the decisions and voices that are yelling about stuff in our culture, and what this means for the faith. I mean, on the one hand, and this will make you happy, we're all going to be martyred eventually here, probably one way or the other, and you like that idea. But I'm thinking about those who are being deceived out of the faith in the present because they're not able to discern the difference between truth and these things that are being told by media heads, which are using words that mean truth, but they're not meaning the truth the words are saying. They're meaning something else. They're stripping them of truth. And it's actually changing people's minds over the course of 10 years or so, a generation or so. And it terrifies me. So yeah, I'm tweeting on it because it's like, whenever I see something that's just contrarian about the news, it's like, yeah, share that. Let's have a different perspective and like try to practice a little discernment here. And that's part of us getting into Christianity too. I mean, we should be practicing discernment in our faith as well. So you will notice, as much as I retweet Ben Shapiro, I also retweet the Babylon Bee, because few things are as valuable in life these days as the Babylon Bee's headlines.
I don't know how Ben Shapiro he is like strong liquor on Twitter. You know,
yeah,
so
he
like
is.
You can listen to his radio show and it's like you're listening to like you're drinking like a fortified wine, but he will distill that stuff down. And then, man, his Twitter account is like a shot of whiskey.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, and I love the things that he connects to or points to. So other news events that the national media does not pick up or will not push. And it's not all Fox either, which is important too. I don't know. It's just stupid. What do I call it? It is the American religion, and I've found myself idolizing it a little bit with the midterms. You know what, though? I mean, this is kind of the thing. Here's what got me. It got me through Albert Mohler again. So I started listening to Albert Mohler because you say he's so great, and so I get addicted to him. Well, what's he always talking about? He's talking about the polis, right? He's talking about what's going on in the world. And I started listening right at the time that the Kavanaugh explosion happens, right?
Yes.
And it radicalized me, not in a, like, I'm going to go kill people sort of way, but it watching the circus that was attempting to lie that man out of his position, all for the sake of protecting abortion. At the end of the day, the whole thing is about protecting abortion. I was radicalized enough that in a state which my vote does not matter if I vote Republican, because I live in Illinois now, in a state that's as Democrat as it, I mean, our whole state voted Democrat on every single thing. I nonetheless voted in my first midterm election ever, strictly out of rage. At abortion, strictly out of rage at abortion and the lies that are being told on a national level to keep that thing what it is.
It is amazing. And it's not always it's there's like three ways that it's a lie too, because it's a lie on the one hand that theft makes everybody rich. That's the kind of underlying lie of socialism. But then there's another lie that the whole debate about. The whole debate about socialism, that by theft can make everybody rich. That's the socialism. That's one lie. But then there's another lie, and that is that the whole, like, the thing that matters most for you and me in our lives is who gets elected during the midterm elections. Well, that it. If we have an understanding about the three estates, back to that again, then we know that if things are good at church and things are good at home, things can fall apart in the neighborhood and it'll still be okay. Life will be tolerable. That there's something much more important than the news. But even that, there's really dangerous about giving our attention only to the things that are new, and forgetting that the real stuff is the stuff that's been around. The real stuff is the stuff that's endured, that there isn't anything new under the sun, and it's one of the important reasons why we need to read these old books. And again, I don't know. I mean, you and I have some attention. Some people listen to our shows, and some people pay attention to, you know, wildly popular. We got like 15 people that listen to Table Talk Radio each week and stuff like this. So, but who knows if our voices will endure to the next generation? I mean, and it doesn't matter. I mean, you and I are going to be dust one day. And if something that we said is helpful to our great grandkids, then God be praised. If it's not, then God be praised. It doesn't matter. But the truth of the Lord's word will in fact endure. Mm. So we want to take a shot at saying something that's helpful, and then let the people who are reading it sort out be for them and their families.
You broke up there again at the end. So this is internet at this point, but we got most of what you were saying there, and that kind of brings us back to the writing task again. So it's at a certain point, the reason that you're writing as a theologian is because you believe that your words will not endure. What you can do with life will not endure, but there are words that will and shall endure. And in a particular way, at this moment in time, you believe they need to be confessed again. You need to believe that they need to be spoken again or tied to some other edge of what we know, but filling in the blind spot of what we've forgotten. And so you and I both, in both our books, in Broken and in Has American Christianity Failed, really went hard after this idea of mysticism, right? The burning of the bosom as if it were the Holy Spirit's work. And the reason for that is because, not because that didn't already exist as a teaching, but because we believe at this particular time and place, we've forgotten that it exists as a teaching. And we found it, and it set us free, and we wanted to share it with others. And, mm-hmm. Echo did the same thing with the catechism, for me, effectively. The next thing I want to do it with, the reason I'm writing what I'm writing, even though I'm really tired of it, I'm so tired of it, I have 15 other things I'd rather be writing, but it needs to, I think it needs to be gotten out, is a recovery of the Lord's Supper as a central hinge point for scriptural inerrancy. And that once you've lost is, it is only a matter of time until you lose everything else to a realm of modernizing disbelief. So let me turn that a little bit now toward martyr's faith in a meandering world. What is it? I can't remember.
Messed up world.
Yeah. Messed up world. What is it that you think we've forgotten that you are compelled to teach us again? What is it that's driving you to think you should write this book?
That the Christians have heroes.
Oh, I like that.
And that the heroes encourage us.
Yeah, that's so
and,
true.
And I think we need, I don't think we just need hope. I think we need courage for these days. And so to know, I mean, remember how in Revelation 12, it says the saints on earth, here comes the devil down in a rage. And the saints on earth overcome him with the blood of the Lamb and the word of the testimony. And they did not love their lives unto death. That idea of overcoming the devil by not loving your life unto death, I think has been lost on us. We love our lives to death. And so to recognize that there's a freedom in not being afraid to die because we belong to Jesus. And we don't just have that in an abstract way. We have it in a very concrete way in the stories of the martyrs that have gone before us.
Your phrase "Christians need heroes" is sticking with me here, and the death issue is worth talking about as well. So maybe we'll come back to the heroes. There are two individuals in my mind from my life as a pastor in the last month and a half or so, both of whom are facing in a variety of ways, not even to their own bodies necessarily, but are facing mortality and the inability of modern medicine to fix their problem. And both of them really, as I try to give them pastoral care, are struggling emotionally with what they... So, well, one of them, she knows it intellectually to be true. Yea, though I die, yet I will live. Though they take our life, good fame, child, wife, these all be gone, the battle still is won. Putting meat on those bones, right? I might lose someone close to me who I really love and not see them again, and it's too soon. That's really watching her try to swallow that. It struck me pretty deep, and then and then contrasting that with this other lady, who, no matter what I say about resurrection and death, always comes back with, but the next doctor that I'm going to go to, I'm pretty sure that they're going to figure out what it is. Mm-hmm. Like, she just won't even hear it. Mm-hmm. And you know, your heart goes out to her too, because like, what kind of fear is dominating you? I don't think it's just her. I think it's emblematic of us. Huh?
Yeah. No, 100%. There's a way that the worship of death, if death is our God, then the worship is fear. And that we're all tempted to that. In fact, that's a natural state of our heart. So that's Hebrews 2. We've talked about this, that the devil holds us in bondage through the fear of death. And so how does freedom come? How does the Lord deliver us and give us freedom? He gives us freedom from the fear of death. It's just wonderfully. By saying, hey, there's no condemnation for those who are in Christ Jesus. Now, we walk through the valley of the shadow of death. I fear no evil, for the Lord is with me. There's this kind of a simple, childlike ignorance of the terrors of death for the Christian. So Luther, some of the saints that Luther loved were Agnes and Agatha. He always got their stories mixed up, and so do I, but both of them were young girls who were martyred, and both of them had this mark is that they were being dragged out of prison, and they were being taken to, I think one was to the beasts and the other one was to the stake, to be burned at the stake. And they both were skipping along the way as if they were going to a dance. they skip along to the stake to be burned. Or the later Protestant martyrs who were burned at the stake by the Catholics, they did the same thing. They would embrace the stake. One would kiss the stake. Another, it tells a story of another one of the martyrs that took up the bundles of sticks that were being heaped around him and held them to his chest in this deep embrace, that here was this joy, because these are now the way that I'm going to go and see the face of my Lord Jesus. Now that, to have that kind of heroic faith, I don't have that by any means, but there are those that the Lord has given it to that have gone before us, and I can hear about them, I can read about them, I can write about them, to hear about that sort of heroic faith. It encourages us when we now have to go and face our own death, and we've just forgotten that there are people who have run this race before us and they finished the race and we're following after them. And the fact that this race is finished is an encouragement. You know, sometimes it's like when I got the Rubik's Cube and I tried to solve the Rubik's Cube for like 10 minutes. And then I said, it's impossible. But then I saw that someone actually did it. And I said, oh, well, maybe I should go back and do it, because this person actually, it's not impossible. It can be done. Well, to finish the race that is set before us, this is possible. And it's encouraging to see those that have run the race before us.
I've seen video of a small Asian boy solving a Rubik's Cube blindfolded in 30 seconds, mm-hmm. which that should just shame you, is basically the point of me sharing that.
Do you know, my son Andrew went to a couple of national competitions for Rubik's
Cube? I did not. There was some kids up in North Dakota that were super into it. They had like the big like 28 side ones or whatever, like all this crazy stuff. I don't know. I don't got the patience for it, but I don't. If I'm not a natural at it, why do it?
If it's not easy.
That's right. It's too hard. Back to your Christians Need Heroes. I think that's that's a better title for your book. Christians Need Heroes is awesome. But as you're describing this, though, it's more than that. It's Christians Need Heroes Who Die, mm-hmm. right? And that's a profound thought, that we don't need the image of Luther standing strong and on a pulpit, right? We need Luther ready to die, right? Able to die. And this is where, in a strange way, Luther's like out of time as a martyr, because he never is martyred, really, right? It's so weird. But that's like the image of him and the success of the Reformation kind of plagues us a little bit. I don't know. And it makes me wonder, too. I remember listening to, I think it was Issues Etc. years ago, and Will Wheaton was being interviewed, and it was on The Lives of the Saints. I think it's The Work, right? Called The Lives of the Saints. Maybe it's not. It was some other thing. But it's the first time I ever heard of the story of Perpetua. But what stunned me about it was he pulled out a resource that he read the story from. I actually have a copy of that resource now somewhere around here. It was published by the LCMS in like the 20s or the 30s. And it's like the history of the world, you know, and it's got the Old Testament saints, it's got New Testament saints, but, you know, and he's reading this part about Perpetua and her abandoning of her infant child to die, you know, because she knows that, you know, it's in God's hands. And Will stops and he says to Todd, you know, we used to teach our kids this stuff. Hmm. And I just went, whoa, you're right. What happened there? You know, how have we sanitized the heroes of the faith? I mean, what stories do we even teach in Sunday school that are about the people dying? Shadrach, mm-hmm. Meshach, and Abednego. We teach that one because they don't die.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. You and I were just talking last week on The Sharper Iron about they loved the world was not worthy of them. They walked around destitute, afflicted. They were cut in half, stoned, rejected. These are the heroes for the Christian. And someone said, this is a psychologist, so it's some famous person said it, I can't remember who, that you can tell anything you need to about a person's ethic by who their heroes are. And that's it just is true. If you want to know what we are endeavoring to do with our lives, what we want to accomplish, then we just say, well, who's our hero? Who are we chasing after? It's one of the dangers of the celebrity culture that these celebrities become our hero. They're useless heroes, but we want to have useful heroes, and we have it in the martyrs, and their victory is their death. This is we should know this because we hear about the death of Jesus, and we know that his victory is his death. Well, so it is for the Christians. Our victory is our death. We think we're victorious if we can avoid death. That is not the Christian. That is not the Christian life. So that we could be made, we can find the fellowship in the death of Jesus. That's how Paul talks about it in Philippians chapter 3, that we can be conformed to the death of Jesus, so that our Christian life is now chasing after these heroes who chased after the cross, or at least were chased down by the cross, and it found them. And to be ready for that is maybe different than it happening. I mean, it's not very likely that you and I are going to be fed to the lions when we die, but there is something really wonderful about being ready to be fed to the lions. There's something really beneficial about being ready to be burned at the stake, because now we are free. We are free. When the fear of death has been consumed by the Lord's death on the cross and his resurrection, when the fear of death has been gobbled up by the promise of the gospel, we are now set free, and there's nothing that the devil can hold over our head to intimidate us. Now we're pressing towards that, but this book is maybe to help me press towards that a little bit more and help my kids press towards that a little bit more, so that they're ready for whatever.
Oh, so okay, as you comes. Say that, I have another question for you, but that reminds me of something that Tim Ferriss has said several times, and it really is helpful. I don't know that I've ever gotten to the point where I'm using this, but I think I will at some point. When you're trying to write and you got that blank page, you're really struggling, you're throwing out four chapters because you don't know what to do with them, right? Stop trying to write a book for the world and pick one person who you know you want to write this book for.
Yeah.
And write to that person.
I have a note that's right there on my desk, and it says, write for Hannah.
Yeah. Yeah.
So that's my 18-year-old daughter. And that's what the first page of the book says. It says to Hannah. But I think I'm gonna change it, and I'm gonna say to Hannah, Andrew, Daniel, and Isaac, because I don't want all of them to expect me to write another book. Can you imagine?
They each need one. He always loved you more.
Where's my book?
He loved you more than me.
I'm tired of writing these books. Yeah.
So my question then is this. I love this bit here too, and I'm paraphrasing it, but you can tell a man by his heroes. That's a beautiful thought. And so I want to ask you who your heroes are, but I'm gonna force you not to cheat. So you can pick one martyr, one New Testament era martyr / one person from before 300, right? But I want you to pick something much more present day-ish. Maybe even somebody who's still alive as at least one of those three. You can have three if you want.
Man, this is one of my problems. So
you love yourself too much. You have no heroes.
Yeah.
No, it's not true.
That sounds like that's like the kind of confession that you would make. Not. No, the most obvious for me is Luther. Luther's always been a hero of mine. I think all the trouble I get in is because Luther's my hero. Luther would just go out there and say it. He didn't care. He'd get in trouble for whatever. He was always making stuff. He was a wanderer, you know. That's really, it's amazing. So Luther is that for me. And as I've studied the martyrs, the guy that I always come back to is this guy Romanus, who had his cheeks cut open, praised the emperor for giving him more mouths to praise his God. That is amazing. In the New Testament, I'm always drawn to Paul, especially to his kind of fearlessness in the book of Acts. I suppose that's kind of an easy answer though. But I want to
force you to do something modern, someone who's still alive. But you're right about Paul. You can finish on Paul if you like. That's good.
So Paul had that sense of adventure. He would go and press. He would push out there.
Dude did not give a rip. He's surrounded by a mob trying to kill him. He gets arrested by soldiers. He's lifted up on their shoulders and they're carrying him away to arrest him and probably beat him. And he talks to the centurion and says, "Hey, can I talk to the crowd again for a moment?"
You're right. That's right. I got a sermon to preach.
I got a sermon to preach. Dude did not care. And it's amazing. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Paul says, I mean, this is the freedom that we're talking about. Paul says, for me to live is Christ, to die is gain. And what are you going to do then? I mean, if you're Paul's enemy.
And he meant it.
Yeah,
he meant it. Man. So give me something modern, man. I want to read on you.
That's my problem. It's one of my things that I think it could be my own pride. It seems to me like we don't have heroes now. We don't have theological heroes. I have people that I've learned from. I have tons of people that I've learned from. I mean, my professor Pless, Dr. Marquardt, who I studied under at the seminary, my seminary professors who were there, pastors that I've served with. I've got friends that that I've fought. You know, you and I have fought beside each other in this theological battle. And I've got a number of other, you know, great friends, Kachemeyer and Melius and Graf and Evan and Flammy, and that are I consider to be co-workers. But it seems to me that one of the things we've lost is this idea of a heroic faith. Of faith that's ready and willing to die. I can name all these people I think that have influenced me and shaped me in one way or another, but I'm not sure. I can't. It's hard to say. It's hard. I don't know the answer to that question.
And that's again, I'm trying to. You can tell a man by his heroes. I'm trying to learn about you from this, but only as a foil to figure it out for myself, and about me. Because it's like the New Testament saints, Paul again, that's an easy one for the Christian to say. At least it's like, well, he ought to be my hero, right? You kind of get stuck in that. And when you have to answer the question with a present day idea, I think it would reveal more about you because you're not allowed to just do the obvious answer. Mm-hmm. I don't know what it revealed about you just now. What just happened? I don't think it's your pride that was revealed, but certainly your longing is being revealed.
I want a hero, you know. And in some ways, this is true. My dad is a huge influence on me, and he's taught me how to think. And my both my grandfathers, and those that have gone before me in the faith, my mom and my grandmothers there's the missionaries that I've met. Mm-hmm. I've got to meet these missionaries over in Asia, in Turkey, in Europe. They're just doing incredible sort of stuff and works of sacrifice. But I don't know. I don't know. Maybe I don't know if you're maybe not allowed to have someone who's alive as your hero.
Well, and I guess in my world and the way I think of heroes, as I was wrestling with that question before I asked you it, my inclination was not to go to a real human, but to someone from a story. And there's no question in my mind, even though I'm not really even a fan of this character, like in a sense of like, I didn't grow up loving this character or anything like that. But the Marvel movies have made me think of their portrayal of Captain America as he is absolutely my hero. And it's stupid in a sense, but you can't just take, you know, Captain America from the comic books and let it all fit. The thing about this guy is he's out of time. Like, he doesn't belong where he is. He's driven by his hunger for virtue and good, even to the point where he's no longer Captain America because America turns their back on him at a certain point, but he's still going to do the right thing for the sake of his neighbor, his friend, his brother, to whom he's eternally committed. And I'm kind of convinced, we don't know, Avengers 4 hasn't come out yet, but I'm pretty sure he's going to die. I'm pretty sure he's going to die in this thing. All the signs are there, you know, and we've talked a little bit about this before, that the great stories always have to borrow from the real story, and the true hero is a sacrificial hero and all this kind of stuff. And so that's got to happen in this next set of movies. But see, if you don't care about movies, that doesn't mean a lot. But that's where my mind went. And so I'm like jealous of you that that your mind goes to real people and to the real faithful. I will say that Hermann Sasse's story is a stunning and depressing one. Of a man who was faithful in so many ways and is never rewarded for it. I mean, dies in ignominy. And yet his words have been words that sustained me in the faith, especially early on in pastoral service. I love Polycarp, if we're going to talk martyrs, because the dude just had some grit and sarcasm. he's burned at the stake, and he says, "Away with the atheists!" Oh, it's great. And he means like all the unbelievers, right? But they were calling him an atheist. And there is a raw episode. You can go. It's called "Away with the Atheist." If you want to hear his story, go check that out. It's good stuff. Luther, of course. This shows my arrogance on the one hand, but we had intramural sports at St. Louis at the SEM. I think you guys probably haven't met at Fort Wayne too, but they're a pretty big deal at St. Louis, and it's one of the ways that the classes cross-pollinate is you get to be on teams with other classes. And we had a flag football was the big fall sport, and my last year there, I got picked up by a second year team for the most part, but they made a big deal about getting everybody T-shirts, and we got to put names on the back of the T-shirts. You can put whatever you want on the back of the T-shirt, and I put Chemnitz on the back of my T-shirt. And I did it precisely because I knew I was going to be the quarterback for the flag football team, so that you would have Chemnitz quarterbacking the team. Mm-hmm. And that, to me, partly it's my arrogance a little bit. Yeah, sure, look at me. But actually, Chemnitz, the unsung hero of the Reformation in so many ways.
Do you know, when Carrie and I, when we got married that first night, I reserved our hotel room under the name Martin Chemnitz, because I knew that they, and sure enough, they came to the hotel and they said, "Is Brian Wolfmuller staying here?" They said, "No." And they said, "Is Martin Luther staying here?" And they said, no Martin Luther. That's so I knew funny. They would ask for Martin Luther as my alias. So I used Martin Chemnitz as my alias that night, so our hotel room didn't get trashed.
That's funny.
But look, I mean, there's really something to think about, is that there were these guys who they risked everything. Not on purpose. I mean, they didn't go out to risk everything. They were just living and loving their neighbor and preaching Christ, and the devil just chomped down on them. And we look at them and we're like, yeah, that's good. That's what I want to happen. Devil, I want you to chomp down on me.
Another guy I love so much. I'm sorry. I just want to share this. You go finish. Me think of somebody else.
And then when we say to the devil, "Hey, I'm ready for you to chomp down on me," we make ourselves distasteful to the devil.
Precisely by our belief that he can't harm us, right?
Yeah, right.
Gustavus Adolphus, the Lion of the North, king of Norway. Do you know this guy?
No, I know just a little bit of the story, but not. They're the ones that went to that. He died in battle, right? And yeah. They were singing the hymn. Let Israel now say.
No. But you're close. Rome has pushed the Lutherans all the way to the north by military might, you know, post-Reformation era, Leipzig interim and all this kind of stuff. And it looks like they're going to lose, right? The German armies just can't do it. So this king of Norway, who's been converted and his whole nation's converted to Lutheranism, brings down his armies and makes a final stand. And actually they win the battle and stop the Roman march and turn the tide of the war and really allow the Lutheran territories to regain eventually their control. But he dies in this battle. Before he leads them into battle, he leads his entire army in "O Little Flock, Fear Not the Foe," which, oh man, next time you sing that hymn, 666, just think about, you know, I am going to possibly die for my faith. And he did it. He did it. What a thing. Pre-Viking era, even. It's just, oh, it's crazy. King of Norway. Anyway,
that's great.
Yeah,
it's
yeah, right.
It's good to have heroes. We got to remember that. It's one of the problems when we talk about the cult of the saints, the Catholic problem. We go overboard and we just throw out the histories of these faithful Christians, and that's a bad idea.
Yeah, yeah. You got to go. You're over your time that you came, but I'm telling you, man, Christians Need Heroes. That should be the title of your book. It's going to be the title of this podcast. Thank you so much for your time and enduring, you know, the failure at the beginning. It's sad we lost the talk about writing, but I think what we talked about here was valuable either way. And it's always good to have you on the show, man.
Yeah, that's right. Thank you.
Was that worth a dollar? What about five? If so, Pastor Fisk and his family would love to have it, in part to pay for technology and paperwork to keep Rev Fisk Raw going, and in part to just enjoy a night out together. Pledging $1.25 on Patreon, only $5 a month, lets the worker know his labor is appreciated. And if you're a true fan, you can give even more. You can find the link to Patreon in the show notes, and check out the other giving levels there, including advertising your product, your family, or your congregation on Rev Fisk Raw. Lock and load, then rock on.